VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. For the third time in U.S. history, the U.S. Senate decided it will not remove an impeached president from office. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
On both articles of impeachment, the vote tallies were nowhere near the Constitution's mandate of two-thirds senators needed to convict.
He is hereby acquitted of the charges in said articles.
Chief Justice John Roberts closing the trial and ending an extraordinary 5 months that saw the Democrat-led House impeach the president before the Senate's GOP majority cleared him. Some Republicans, like Lindsey Graham, say it shouldn't have gotten this far.
This is an injustice to President Trump as a person.
For number two Senate Democrat Dick Durbin, it's more GOP cover for a president who seems to enjoy blind loyalty.
There is nothing this president can do or say that rises to the level of blush-worthy, let alone impeachable.
Mitt Romney was the only Republican voting for either of the articles. Sagar Magani at the White House.
And reaction was swift, with President Trump's political campaign tweeting videos, statements, and a cartoon dance celebrating that he was vindicated. At a Women for Trump rally, Vice President Mike Pence said the Democrats had failed in their attempts to overturn the president's election.
Senate Republicans came forward. President's been acquitted. They've had their say. Come November, we're going to have our say when we re-elect President Donald Trump for four more years in the White House.
And Mr. Trump himself tweeted that he would speak from the White House on Thursday about it. China is likely considering using a disaster-related clause in its Phase 1 trade deal with the United States due to the coronavirus outbreak that has killed more than 500 and infected tens of thousands. The Global Times, published by the official People's Daily Newspaper of China, ruling Communist Party, cited an unnamed Chinese trade expert. This is VOA News. Former Vice President Joe Biden admits that the Iowa caucuses were a gut punch to him and the Democratic Party. AP correspondent Tim McGuire explains why.
After his lackluster showing in Iowa, former Vice President Joe Biden says he's in the race for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination for the long haul.
I'm going to fight for it here in New Hampshire and in Nevada and then in South Carolina and beyond.
Some establishment Democrats admit they're worried about Biden ahead of Tuesday's New Hampshire balloting. And now he faces problems in his firewall state, South Carolina. A number of black legislators there demanding Biden disavow comments made by longtime supporter State Senator Dick Harpootlian, which they say insinuated the legislative black caucus chairman Jerry Govan had been bought by Biden rival Tom Steyer, who hired the lawmaker as a senior advisor. Harpootlian says Govan had previously backed Biden until, quote, Mr. Moneybag showed up. I'm Tim McGuire.
The World Health Organization has appealed for $675 million to prevent the global spread of the deadly coronavirus. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the small number of cases and deaths circulating around the world provides a window of opportunity to prevent the coronavirus outbreak from becoming a wider global crisis.
Our message to the international community is invest today or pay more later.
Tedros says he understands that people are worried about the evolution of this unknown disease, but he notes this is not a time for fear and panic. He says it is a time for evidence-based action to end this outbreak while there is still time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now, one of the last survivors of Hollywood's golden age, movie legend Kirk Douglas, has died. AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
He was simply an American original.
I'm not afraid of emotion. When I paint the sun, I want to make people feel it revolving, giving off light and heat.
Kirk Douglas, the intense actor with the chiseled, dimpled chin, has died, according to his family. He was 103. Douglas brought his dynamic, powerful presence to the big screen in more than 80 films, including Spartacus and The Champion.
People cheering for me. Death, didn't you hear him?
Nominated for an Academy Award but never winning three times, Douglas received an honorary Oscar in 1996. I'm Mike Gracia.
And finally, again, his son, actor Michael Douglas, announced his father's death Wednesday afternoon in Los Angeles. Again, Kirk Douglas was 103. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon's government says all is ready for Sunday's controversial legislative and municipal election.
All the parties who are accepted to run for the elections are doing their campaign. The CPDM, which is the main party, is on the ground, is on the field. The other parties also are on the field.
René Emmanuel Sade is Cameroon's communication minister. Malawian President Peter Mutharika challenges a court ruling nullifying his re-election last year. Liberia's new central bank governor will discuss restoring financial stability in Liberia. And the World Health Organization seeks hundreds of millions of dollars to prevent the spread of the coronavirus.
Our greatest concern is about the potential for spreading countries with weaker health systems and who lack the capacity to detect or diagnose the virus.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is WHO Director General. A new report says companies make bigger profits investing in Africa than in other regions. And today is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Cameroon's information minister says his country is ready for Sunday's February 9th legislative and municipal elections despite threats by separatists and a boycott by opposition leader Maurice Kamto. Communication Minister René Emmanuel Sade says all the parties, including the ruling People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, and the opposition Social Democratic Front, SDF, have been campaigning throughout the country. Separatist spokesperson Chris Anun says the group will impose a lockdown in the northwest and southwest English-speaking regions to prevent the controversial elections from taking place there. René Emmanuel says the government has taken all necessary measures to make the election free and fair.
All the parties who are accepted to run for the elections are doing their campaign. The CPDM, which is the main party, is on the ground, is on the field. The other parties also are on the field. Even SDF, which is the main party in the Anglophone area, they're also campaigning. So I think that there is quite a good atmosphere in the whole country. So I think everything is going on quite smoothly. We have not had any problem. All the parties are on the ground, on the field. They are all accompanied by journalists, public media and private media. So I think we should be quite satisfied with what is going on, because some people thought that there won't be any campaign, but the government has taken all the conditions for everybody, and the campaign is going on. So what I can say is that on the 9th of February, that is on Sunday, election day, and everybody will go and cast their vote.
Mr. Kamto, the opposition leader, is boycotting the election. The separatists or the Ambazonians have vowed that there can be no election held in the Anglophone region. Given these circumstances, do you think any election on Sunday can be seen as free and fair?
Well, first of all, let me say that Mr. Kamto, he decided not to run for the elections. That's his own decision. But I can tell you that even within his party, a good number of the militants were not in agreement with him. So he has taken that decision. I think, as you know, we say in French, les absents to do store. That is, the people who are absent, well, it is their own problem. As far as the Ambazonians are concerned, from what I can say and see on the field, measures have been taken by the government, and we think that on the 9th of February, the election will take place. So there's no reason why on Sunday, the 9th of February, people will not go and vote.
How does the government see how this crisis can be resolved in a peaceful way?
Let me tell you that we had the national dialogue, which took place some months ago. And as you can remember, all the people who count in this country were there. The dialogue was a very big opportunity for Cameroonians to change on these matters. And the decision that came out in the conclusions of the dialogue were very important and pertinent. And one of the decisions concerning the Northwest and the Southwest, as you know, is that those areas will have the benefit of a special status. And this special status will be implemented in the days to come.
Mr. Minister, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Rede Emmanuel Sadis, Cameroon's communication minister, he was speaking with us from the capital, Yaoundé. Malawian President Peter Mutharika says he is ready to campaign for the next election and will win as usual. Addressing the nation Wednesday evening, the president also said he will appeal the Constitutional Court's ruling overturning the results of the May 21, 2019 presidential election and ordering fresh elections in 150 days. Mr. Mutharika said he is challenging the court decision not because he wants to hold on to power, but because he wants to correct what he calls fundamental errors in the court ruling. The court said the May 2019 election was marked by widespread, systematic, and grave irregularities. The court also reinstated former Vice President Solus Chelima. Ngemi Kalilani is the spokesperson for President Mutharika.
Having looked at the content of the judgment, the president and the team of his lawyers are of the view that the judgment represents a serious miscarriage of justice and that the judgment is a threat to Malawi's democratic systems and an attempt to circumvent the will of the people. Like the president said, such a situation cannot be left unchallenged. So for us to preserve the principles of justice in the country and the foundations on which our democracy is founded, the president has found merit in the decision to take the matter up to the Supreme Court, hoping that the Supreme Court will cure the defects that have been occasioned in the decision of the High Court.
The ruling of the five-panel Constitutional Court was unanimous. And that brings to question, what are the chances of an appeal? Also, people suggesting that the talk of an appeal by the president is just an attempt, that he's buying time to continue to remain in power, even though the judgment was unanimous.
Well, we agree that the decision of the Constitutional Court was unanimous. But the fact that the decision is unanimous in itself doesn't mean that the decision could not be erroneous. We have, in history, many occasions in which popular decisions ended up being proven to be wrong. It's not new. I'll give you an example. One of the gray areas that we are trying to analyze in our process towards submitting grounds for the appeal is a complete attack on the principle of separation of powers in the Constitution of Malawi.
According to the court ruling, former Vice President Solus Chilima has been reinstated.
Yes.
Assuming the decision stands, does President Mutharika see any chance of working with his former Vice President, Mr. Solus Chilima? Because if you look at it, it sounds like it's going to be like a kind of an odd couple.
Well, the way we look at this, it's not up to the president to decide whether he will work with his vice president as reinstated by the court order or not. It's not up to the president. This is an order from the court. And in our democracy, orders from the court, whether they don't agree with them or not, whether they are fallacious or not, you'd have to agree with them until there is an order contrary to the initial order. So it's not up to the president to decide whether he will work with the vice president or not. It is a matter of law, and it has to be as it is.
Ngemi Kalanani is the spokesperson for Malawian President Peter Mutharika. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 6th. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Amid a struggling economy, Liberian President George Weah recently named Joelu Aloysius Talu as the country's second bank governor in a few years. Talu will have to deal with stabilizing Liberia's monetary policy and the devaluation of the Liberian dollar. His appointment followed the resignation of indicted former Bank Governor Milton Weeks and Nathaniel Patrick for their alleged involvement in the country's missing local currency. Reporter Moses Gaziewu asked Governor Talu just what it would take to restore the image of the Central Bank of Liberia.
My immediate plan is to build confidence in this bank. My immediate plan is to reposition this. My immediate plan is to rebrand this bank. We want this bank to be the people's bank. I want to be the people's governor.
The president said in his annual message, they were depoliticizing the Central Bank of Liberia.
Well, that was a great relief. In fact, the president spent extensive time in his State of the Nation address to talk about the Central Bank and how the depoliticization of the bank and how the bank will be independent, you know, how there will be no borrowing from the bank, how there will be no interference from the bank. And I think it's great. And the president really wants to leave us alone, do our work. And now partners are excited, too, that they're willing to help us to make sure the bank gets its footing, that we return to doing the people's work, return to making sure that the economy begins to work for the people, that it begins to grow. If we do a better job, we can lend money, microfinance money to women, to young people, upcoming businesses, and that will create jobs.
For the last 2 years, the image of the bank has been bleak as it relates to controversies arising from alleged missing local currency and a mop-up exercise that was brought under questioning. What are your messages to the Liberian people and people who've lost trust in this bank?
We will try to make this bank apolitical. We will try to restore confidence here. We will make sure that the mistakes of the past are not repeated. And that's one reason why we want to strengthen our corporate governance and want internal control. Because if internal controls were working, maybe some of these issues would have been flagged a long time ago before they became worse. So hopefully we can change the story so Liberian people can have confidence in what we do here. My job now is to ensure that we rebuild, rebrand, and reposition the bank. Make sure the bank is operating like any traditional central bank. We need a vibrant economy. A vibrant economy.
And the central bank, you think, can contribute to that?
Good central banks can create a job growth. If we have a credible microfinance system where small businesses are loan money and they pay back, and as they become credit worthy, they get more money, they grow their businesses.
So some of your key emphasis will be placed on how to promote microfinance.
Microfinancing, financial inclusion, women, young people, people who are outside of the financial system, we've got to bring them in. Financial literacy, financial sensitization.
This brings me to the question when the president said the central bank has said it wants to digitize the monetary sector of the country.
In the age of technology and the economy is very important. Digitization is very, very key to a functioning and effective banking system. You want to ensure that the banks are talking to each other technologically. You can take your money from EcoBank and wire money to UBA and to other banks. You can send money to me just by that, or going to the bank. When you use the money less, you have less interaction with money, that will reduce the wear and tear on the money, mutilate the money. So imagine you're going to buy something and you spend $200,000. Do you know how long it takes to count that money? But if you guys have bank accounts, the person can just go on a mobile phone, give it to your account, and you two pay your vendors. And that. So the age of digitalization is here.
And how long is it going to take Liberia?
Not too long. I think we're almost there. The World Bank is also funding a project on the payment system and digitalization. I think I would say, for me, as an optimistic kind of person, about a year from now, we should get on a platform.
Yolu Aloysius Talu is the new governor of the Central Bank of Liberia. He was speaking with reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Companies make bigger profits investing in Africa than in any other regions of the world, according to a new report from the Overseas Development Institute, which urges global firms to seek profits on the continent rather than seeing it as a place to do charitable work. Henry Richwell spoke to African business leaders and entrepreneurs at the recent UK-Africa Investment Summit about their hopes for trade with Britain now that it has officially left the European Union.
Britain is looking for new partners and it's eyeing Africa. With 1.2 billion people and eight of the world's 15 fastest growing economies, Africa offers world-beating returns on investment, according to a report from the Overseas Development Institute.
In the past 20 years, it's about 16%. And this is much higher than in other countries. Even if you look at returns in Latin America and other developing countries, this case of higher returns in Africa is definitely should encourage more UK investments in the continent.
Britain is playing catch-up. Data from agency the International Trade Center show France and Germany export more than double the value of goods to Africa than Britain does. At a London summit earlier this month, African business leaders said Britain must get proactive post-Brexit.
If the UK just sit down, the vessel will go, the train will move.
UK companies need to come and work with the African business model.
British companies believe they have an edge on technology. The UK Space Agency is backing satellite firms that offer services to African farmers, like the PRISE, or Pest Risk Information Service. Chris Castelli is Director of Programmes at the UK Space Agency.
So it's taking terabytes of satellite data and sending out text alerts to farmers, which can tell them when a pest might become a problem in the future.
African entrepreneurs are seeking investment in homegrown technology. MobiHealth is a mobile app that seeks to offer top-level healthcare access across Africa.
90% of our doctors are from the Western countries, 10% from the rest of Africa. They provide video consultation, prescription, diagnostic test. We are looking here to connect with people who can help us to scale up our business and take this global.
African nations need to work harder to attract investment, says the Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development.
We need to develop this human resource as a contribution to the world's economy, that we need to write the conditions to make Africa the next factory of the world. Then you can say, can Britain step in just like any other friend of Africa and offer some of the solution?
Britain says it can. But many analysts warn negotiations over its future relationship with Europe will dominate trade talks in the coming months and years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Today, February 6, is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation, or FMG, dedicated to amplify awareness of the dangers associated with the practice. Officials in Uganda said the practice is on the rise in the country. Peace Mutuzo, Uganda's Minister of State for Gender and Culture, says the government has introduced laws to fight FGM. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinja has more from Kampala.
Mutuzo says despite the efforts to eradicate the vice, there are still some communities, especially the eastern part of the country, where FGM has resurged.
There is a disturbing trend of FGM surge, which was observed within a period of 4 months between November 2018 to January 2019 in Kapchorwa, Kwen, Buko districts, and was estimated to have involved around 350 girls and women who were mutilated. And this was done in secrecy.
Globally, about 200 million girls and women, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, have undergone FGM, which usually involves the partial or total removal of the external genitalia for non-medical reasons, according to the UN. At least 4.1 million girls around the world are at risk of undergoing female genital mutilation in this year alone. FGM can have long-term socioeconomic as well as physical consequences, some of which are irreversible.
Some of the effects include severe bleeding, which may lead to death, permanent scars that may block the birth canal, fistula, urine, incontinence, permanent disability, depression, trauma, feeling of disgust and loss of libido, among others.
This year's theme is Unleashing Youth Power, one decade of accelerating actions of zero female genital mutilation. Mutuzo says it is important to engage the youth because they are the ones that are mainly affected. She says the government is embarking on sensitization programs in communities where the practice is highly prevalent.
We have also put up a helpline for children who instantly report any occurrence or any issue in their community. There is straight talk where children call in or write papers, and also the teachers in their school curriculum, in their training, we ensure that we train them about some of these other social norms.
Mutuzo says the government is allocating 1.5 billion Uganda shillings, or about $400,000, to fight the practice. Uganda also passed laws that punish those involved in FGM. Alessi Benella is the UN Population Fund representative in Uganda. He says traditional beliefs also increase FGM in communities.
I am of the opinion that culture should not be used as an excuse to perpetuate human rights violations. Now, both child marriage and female genital mutilations are forms of gender-based violence and are forms of human rights violations.
The UN has set 2030 to have fully eliminated female genital mutilation. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
The World Health Organization, WHO, is appealing for $675 million to prevent the global spread of the deadly coronavirus. Most of the money will support countries with weaker health systems so they can protect their populations over the next 3 months. Henry Listerschlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the small number of cases and deaths circulating around the world provides a window of opportunity to prevent the coronavirus outbreak from becoming a wider global crisis.
Our greatest concern is about the potential for spreading countries with weaker health systems and who lack the capacity to detect or diagnose the virus. We're only as strong as the weakest link.
WHO has released $9 million from its emergency fund. The money is being used to provide essential supplies to countries at risk. These include 500,000 masks, more than 350,000 gloves, and tens of thousands of respirators, gowns, and diagnostic tests. But Tedros says much more has to be done to help shore up health systems in developing countries. He says the multi-million dollar strategic response plan will support vulnerable countries to prevent, detect, and diagnose onward transmission. Tedros notes the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has contributed $100 million to fight the further spread of the coronavirus. He says he hopes governments will be as generous.
Our message to the international community is invest today or pay more later. $675 million is a lot of money, but it's much less than the bill we will face if we do not invest in preparedness now during the window of opportunity that we have.
Tedros says he understands that people are worried about the evolution of this unknown disease, but he notes this is not a time for fear and panic. He says it is a time for evidence-based action to end this outbreak while there is still time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Briefly, before we leave you, summary of Africa News. Cameroon's information minister says his country is ready for Sunday's February 9th legislative and municipal elections, despite threats by separatists and a boycott by opposition leader Maurice Kamto. That is it for this Thursday, February 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, protection, patronage, or plunder? A new book examines how colonialism influenced the development of the Ugandan Kingdom of Buganda. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Rock and roll, America's finest export. Our culture and music of today are permanently indebted to the pioneers who trailblazed this musical tradition. Listen to Border Crossings on February 6th to hear rock's greatest musicians like Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly, and Elvis Presley. Only on The Voice of America.